Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, award-winning author Gabriel Bump discusses his new novel, The New Naturals. He is joined in conversation by author Adam Levin. The following conversation originally took place December 3rd, 2023, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum.
Thank you all for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. Today's program is presented in conjunction with our exhibit, Dark Testament, 100 Years of Black Writers on Justice. In The New Naturals, Gabriel Bump imagines a new kind of society built by those grieving, rejected, and dispossessed, a place to learn real history and feel accepted and welcomed and loved. Gabriel grew up in South Shore, Chicago. He received his MFA in fiction from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. His debut novel, Everywhere You Don't Belong, was a New York Times notable book of 2020 and has won the Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence and many other honors. He teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's joined by Adam Levin, author of the novels The Instructions, Bubblegum, and Mount Chicago, as well as the story collection Hot Pink. His writing has appeared in numerous publications, including The New Yorker, McSweeney's, and Playboy. Please join me in welcoming them both.
Thanks for coming. Thanks for having me. This place is like really cool. It opened after I moved away, and like I haven't been up here before. And actually, it seems fitting because I feel like we met maybe like three blocks away. And like the Art Institute.
Yeah.
So this is really cool for me for like a lot of reasons. One, like seeing like all my family and like friends out here is nice. My dad gets the whole front row to himself as he should. Because this is like it's, and we'll talk about this a little bit. So I'm going to read just a couple pages here before we get into the conversation. But it's a real like emotional book. There's a lot like sadness, like kind of mixed in with like hope and happiness. And I feel like even more so than my previous book, this one, like, I don't know, I needed a lot of help, like outside of just the writing from people to like kind of get through it. They were just going through this really tumultuous time. And I think we'll touch kind of like some of that stuff when I first started writing it. So now like seeing it kind of laid out like this is a good example of things just being able to naturally improve in your life if they're feeling kind of down and crummy. It's not all sad. Okay, so here's a section, just a couple pages. So the story is told through six point of views, give or take, and this point of view is two homeless men in Chicago that hear about this utopia in Western Massachusetts just through like word of mouth. And then they get on a bus and head eastward. And so this is them stopped at a rest station. And it's Elting and Buchanan. And Buchanan has run into the bathroom because he's not feeling so well. Elting waited at the bathroom entrance next to a claw machine filled with frayed stuffed animals. People were starting to stare, hurry past him, look back over their shoulders. The bus was supposed to leave soon. The driver wasn't going to wait again. Not after Indianapolis, when Buchanan hid under a table at Subway and refused to leave until Elting confirmed the Hungarian tourists at Dunkin' Donuts weren't speaking an ancient language designed for mind control. They were 30 minutes behind schedule then. The world outside Chicago didn't make sense to Buchanan. Elting was his guide. As an effective guide should, Elting walked into the bathroom and screamed, "Buchanan, Buchanan, 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 I'm here." Buchanan poked his head out from under the stall. Tired and rushing men, in unison, paused and watched Elting move toward Buchanan. Elting crouched and moved in a crab-like waddle, careful not to touch the floor. Elting impressed the crowd with his speed and awkward grace. "Is everything okay?" a man in a Cleveland Browns jersey asked. "Just call the cops," another man said. The man in the Cleveland Browns jersey interrupted Elting's path. Elting stared at the man's thighs. "Kick him over," a man brushing his teeth said. "They're on dope," a man said after zipping up his pants. "We're not addicts," Buchanan yelled. "We are pilgrims," Elting said, stuck in his crab-like position. "Enough." The man in the Cleveland Browns jersey rested his right hand over his heart. The left, he rested on his hanging stomach. With the room at attention, the man in the Cleveland Browns jersey questioned the room's humanity. "Who are we?" he asked, "to look down on our fellow humans? Who are we?" he asked, "to call the cops on friends? Who here," he asked, "hasn't taken two hits of acid when the occasion, the setting, called for one? Who among us," he asked, "hasn't heeded friendship's call when a companion has fallen ill?" The gathered men grew bored and resumed their business, turning faucets, wiping hands, zipping, grunting, moaning, exhaling, releasing, flushing. "Thank you," Elting said to the man in the Cleveland Browns jersey. The man put his hand under Elting's armpits and hoisted. They were eye to eye, unsure how to conclude their interaction. "Thank you," Elting said. "You were kind." The man wiped a tear from his left eye, nodded, mouthed something inaudible, gripped Elting's shoulders, and mouthed something else. "What?" Elting asked. And the man was out the door. Behind him, lingering, a mysterious and kind aura. So that's Elting and Buchanan in a rest stop bathroom. So yeah.
That was awesome. I think I'd mentioned to Gabe, these are, I particularly adore these two characters. Gabe, who I've been reading for many years at this point, has always had this this fantastic talent to sort of bring across like the human and also like the gross, as well as the, you know, the darker sides of people. But you know, you can set a thing in a truck stop bathroom basically, and we don't feel like it's just you're making fun of people. And so with these two, I should back up and say the point of saying all that is that all the characters in this book sort of have these, they're multifaceted, but these two particularly are like, I adore them. Like, you know, there's characters that you're like, I want to follow them, I want to hear their story. And then there's characters that you kind of love and you just, you're almost waiting. Just you're like, when are they going to come back? Like they're very charismatic. And so, you know, some of the reasons are, you know, that these two, they're funny, they're kind to one another. They have this great rapport and they have really, really great comic timing, actually. Those are reasons to like them. But like what I want Gabe to tell us is the secret on how he gets us to love them. Mm-hmm. So it's a hard question, maybe. Yeah.
I guess like first, so I think I get a lot of that style you were actually explaining, like from like studying and reading your work. I think like both like as an adult and then as like a student. And honestly, like for better or worse, I probably wouldn't be a writer if like it wasn't for Adam, like his like encouragement or stuff. I don't know if this is what I should be doing, but like I'm doing it.
It's what you should be doing.
Yeah, because he's a really great just teacher, mentor, and friend. And I think that the way that like you approach your characters in your like big complex books too, is something like I am kind of obsessed with doing in my books is like trying to make, I guess, first myself like fall in love with them. Mm. Like I'm always approaching my characters and their interactions with each other, like with the goal of reaching some like deeper understanding of them. Like there's like the plot stuff, there's like the craft stuff that sometimes like come secondary to that, right? Like it's always, so with Elting and Buchanan, I think is a good example of that, because they don't really have like anything to do with how this novel operates, right? Like, so it's about this, a couple, this professor couple in Massachusetts that kind of experience this horrible tragedy in their lives and decide to build this underground utopia in Western Massachusetts. And the two other characters, besides Elting and Buchanan and these professors, the two other main characters, are just like lost people in Western Massachusetts that actually like stumble upon this place and kind of like fall in love with each other. It's like a love story. So this book can like exist without like Elting and Buchanan.
Right.
And like, and one of the reasons why I feel like they have to be in this book is because like I love them. Right.
And like, that's a great reason.
And like, I just think they're, as they just grew, right, they like, the threads like were growing, their journey was growing. And I was like, wait, this is actually like really exciting. Like, I really like this. And it doesn't really serve any like function in the plot, except to show that a place like this and like an idea like the New Naturals, like its purpose almost, but what ends up happening is it just attracts like desperate people from everywhere. And so it's like, here are these desperate people that are trying to like find this place too. So I don't know. I guess like I don't know what the secret is besides like usually the thing that we feel about our characters, we want the reader to feel about them
sure.
too, right? And so it's like at every page, every like sentence and paragraph, like I'm just trying to like fall in love with these people and hoping that the reader does too.
Yeah, no, it's good. You're trusting the reader.
Yeah,
it is, because I think, you know, yeah, I mean, I don't want to blow anything in the book, because I actually do think that where they land does end up doing a lot for the story, even if it's not like plot wise, it's not causative, right? Yeah. Like, but where they land is very, there's some parallels. I don't want to speak too vaguely.
And that was like always the, like their ending was always going to be the ending of this novel. Like now there's like a step for, like, there's kind of a step beyond there. But like, I knew the final scene was like going to be with them, and without giving anything away, like I knew it was going to be in Cleveland, Ohio, because I just really like love Cleveland.
Do you really? You love Cleveland?
And Buffalo, whole Rust Belt.
You got a lot of parks in Cleveland. That's all. I've been there once.
Yeah, great bookstores too. They have amazing. Amazing bookstore in Cleveland.
I did not see any bookstores. Messed up. No, that's great. I think it's one can feel that. Like one feels the author's affection for these characters. I think really for all the characters, but these particularly, they're, I don't know, there's something very glowing about them. Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing that I noticed too is like and it was sort of what I was saying earlier, is like there's like this capacity with all of these characters to do like really sort of grounded kind of human things and be a little bit ugly sometimes, mm-hmm. and still they come across whole. And I think that's part of it. Like, you know, these two, they're pretty saintly once we get to them together. Because earlier we have, it's Elting, I believe. Yeah. We meet first, and Elting's a little bit, what's the word the kids say? Problematic for a minute, like when we meet him, and then this is sort of the after that. So it's you pull it off quite well. So one thing that, you know, in terms of the larger story, so you're this very deliberate writer who's always recognized that what's left out of any story you're telling is nearly as important and occasionally more important than what's put in. And so in the New Naturals, there's this conspicuously like minus aspect of the narrative that you would think would be there. If I tell you we're going to read a book about a couple that starts a utopian society. And that's basically what regular old kind of like day-to-day life is, what it looks like in that society. And we get a sense of what it might be. or what it might have been, but not until it's already kind of falling apart. Yeah. And this was clearly a deliberate choice. Like, and so I was wondering if you could talk about that a bit, like why you made it, not you know, necessarily a thesis unless there is one.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, it was like a real conscious choice that I was thinking about, like throughout multiple drafts of this, right? It was because better to talk about where this book like actually started.
Sure.
With the writing. So like this book started with a chapter with like Sojourner and Bounce. Like these two characters are just down on their luck, and like really need someone. Bounces this like failed former athlete that like can't seem to like put his feet right, like he's sleeping. At the point we meet him in the story, he's staying in his sister's house, like sharing a bathroom with his niece. And Sojourner has just kind of blown up her life and just fled into the mountains and like the hill towns in Massachusetts. And so a story started with those two characters, and they were together when the book started, and they were just like so like broken, right? In this way that they could be like broken and vulnerable together and were like kind of healing with each other, but they weren't like healing. Like they weren't getting better. They were just like with each other, and they just like needed each other. And then the story like just started to kind of blossom out of that. It was like, okay, they find something in the hill, like they stumble across this utopia. And it was like this reverse engineering. It was, okay, so what is this utopia? Like, who did it? And then Rio and Gibraltar became characters. And then like I started thinking a little bit more about what this place actually looked like. But it was just never the point of the story. Like, it was never the point of like the writing. It was never the point that like I was even most interested in, mm-hmm. right? Like, I was always really interested in the people. And I became interested in like the founders just by spending more time with them, right? Like Rio and Gibraltar. And like this idea kind of grew into this, okay, so how would we make this society underground? Like how, there's one thread in the story that like works through how you get the money for such a project, right? Like how do you make something like this happen? But I just never became that interested in it, like as a writer. I was just solely interested in the characters. And that's why I think that like it might, well, because there's one aspect of this is like, okay, how something is like marketed, right? As opposed
sure.
to like,
sure.
As opposed to like what the kind of author is like most interested in. But like seeing the reviews have been interesting to me, because like a common thread for people is like that they wanted to see more, or like feel this urge to like see more of this utopia. And it's like interesting because they just want a different book.
Right.
Right. And right. like, it's, and I get that, right? Like, I don't know, books are expensive. And like, if you're
I
like,
thought I okay. bought a utopia book.
Yeah. You're like, yeah. I spent like $27 on this. Like, what the, but like, I like,
you didn't call it utopia book.
No, I called it. And so, like, what I, but I still think that, like, when I approach a book, and I think that, like, there's a few, and I'm not going to do this with like every question, but I feel like they're, like when we were at the Art Institute, right, like in the classroom, like I think a common thread in those classes was like, how do we surprise the reader, right? Like, how do we give the reader something that they don't know that they want,
yep.
right? Like, how do we surprise ourselves? And I feel like that was what I was like writing towards here too. I was like, okay, what's like a different way to approach this idea of utopia, right? And ultimately where it lands up is that like we're searching for these like big ideas and grappling with these big systemic problems, and it just boils down to these like intimate relationships with people, like with each other, right? Like with whether it's Elsie Buchanan and this like really platonic, like you know, platonic love, whether it's Sojourner and Bounce who are saved by like this romantic love, right? Like they really need that kind of healing in their life, or like Rio and Gibraltar, like driven by like grief and understanding and like just real like powerful ambition. Like those are the most interesting things, I think, in life, right? I don't know. Like,
that's
the interesting stuff to explore in life.
No, I agree. I think, the book definitely carries through. And I mean, for what it's worth, like when I read the summary of it in advance of, you know, reading it, I was excited, but I was kind of like, I don't think it's going to be a utopia novel. Like, I was like, just because, you know, having read you. I one expects from Gabriel Bump's work that it will be very character driven.
Well, I don't know, because like also when I would sit down, because I tried to like write more of the day to day stuff, because I was these weren't like hard conversations with my publisher and editor, but there were like in the first drafts, there was like none of that stuff. Like it was honestly like just characters, and like there was the idea was floating in the background. And my editor smartly was like, you can't just like do that. Like that's just that's not how like books work. Like I don't care what you're trying to pull off, like you can't do it. And so he just started like adding more. And what I found out is that because like when you're writing something, like the sentence is the thing.
Right.
It's like how do you come back to this thing and just like allow the sentences to like stack up on top of each other in interesting and like surprising ways. And when I was just like trying to explain the like day-to-day functions of this place, like the sentences kind of started to get dull, right? Like my brain, it's like they moved the oranges from like this room to like that room something, right? Like,
right.
It just feels less exciting.
Yeah. It's not intriguing. It wasn't intriguing to you to imagine it.
Yeah. Exactly.
So it's like, yeah. So how's it going to come out? I think it makes a lot of sense within the book when you started, but yeah, the marketing thing, I think that is the only interference because if there is any, like if someone comes at it thinking that's what I'm going to read is this utopia book.
Yeah. And I wonder, have you had a, like, cause I regret or I'd like hesitate to even call it like a problem cause it's just like the way it is. Right. But have you felt that way? Like with your,
oh yeah. Books? I mean, yeah. 100%. Yeah. Yeah. No, with all of them really. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like even from my first book, you know, people claiming that the allegory I wrote about Israel was off.
Yeah.
And I was like, what allegory about it? Like, what, you know, like, yeah. who said anything about, like, yeah. That was like, the copy doesn't even say that. Like, you know, but yeah, I think along the way, that's a thing, but it's like, you know, that's I think the way, that's the sausage factory stuff, man. That's how they sell the stuff is they say something quick about it. It's always, I think with stories as well as with novels too, anytime you could potentially do an accurate summary of a piece of writing, it's probably a pretty bad piece of writing. Mm. Like if it's fiction,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, you want the thing to be elevated, to be kind of impossible to say in, to describe in fewer words than it takes to write it.
Yeah. and I guess like we're thinking, cause like we're at the Writers Museum, when you were saying it's just like, so I read like a bunch of Saul Bellow, I think I was telling you.
Yeah.
Like earlier, so I read a bunch of Saul Bellow books. And like, I couldn't like give summaries of like what happens to them, right? Like, besides, yeah, this old guy kind of like, I don't know, like sleeps around too much, is like kind of sad.
Yeah.
And like they're like 700 pages.
The joke that my wife and I have is like someone asks you about what your book's about. It's pretty much it's about a sad person.
Yeah.
Like it's like it's like what they're all about. Like what do you mean?
It's like sad people trying to get happy.
Yeah, I think that's that's a thing. Yeah, that's just a thing that's going to happen probably more and more. But you know it's okay because I think that most people who read literary fiction, who actually care about the form, I think they tend not to get books because of what a reviewer says or because of the copy on the back. I think at least I shouldn't speak for everyone, but for me, for sure, the thing that gets me to read a book is someone who I trust being like, "This is a good book."
Yeah.
A lot of the book kind of threatens along the way to turn a reader kind of cynical, right? Mm-hmm. Like we read about a bunch of likable, heartful, sometimes lovable romantics repeatedly encountering like terrible luck and abuse and sometimes getting pretty crushed, irrevocably crushed in a couple of cases. But we come out of the other side with some hope. And I'm more curious, really, I understand the mechanics of that. And I think anyone who read the book would be like, oh, okay, you know. But I am curious, at what point do you realize it's heading that way? Like,
yeah, I think that like that's It's a weird long story that I think is like worth telling. I get right, like, which I don't, you know, maybe not all, like the writing of a novel is like, you know, I sit down and like I write it, and then after enough days and pages, like it's done, you do a draft. But I feel like with this one, so like I started it, again, like I was saying, I was just kind of, like my whole kind of life in Western Mass had blown up. Like I just moved to Buffalo. But even before that, like I'd like come back to Chicago. I think I saw like you and Camille in this time. Like we like hung out one night and was like just bouncing around friends' like couches, like staying at like home, and then just decided one morning to like move to Buffalo. And I remember like the look on your face when I told you I was moving to like Buffalo. You said you can move anywhere in the world. And even looking back, it's hard to really explain, like emotionally, like what was going on with me, like what was like going wrong, right? There was just like this really deep, like sadness and like solitude and this urge to just kind of like release myself, right? From, like remove myself, right? Like this, from like family and friends, just kind of be alone in Buffalo for an extended amount of time and just write. And so one of the reasons why this book, especially when we meet the characters, like, and they are in these really desperate situations and they're like really sad, it's because I just felt like it's not like I was writing through the experience that I was having, right? But that's just where I was like coming from in this really real way. I was like, okay, here are all these sad people that I'm going to put in this book. And my goal wasn't even to make them like happy, right? My goal was to like just see what happens to them. Like if maybe they could, like become, maybe like just some, like the journey takes them someplace unexpected. So I guess just refer directly to like the beginning of your question. Like this was a really cynical book, like from the onset of it, right? This was just like, life isn't working. Like the world is like horrible. And even like when you get to the end of this book, like it's not like there's a real happy ending.
No rainbows.
Yeah, right. Like it's nothing is like clear. And like those endings, like I knew were gonna happen. Like I knew that those endings from the onset, like were gonna be there. And so it's like interesting is the reason why I think there is so much like humor and hope in this book is because like eventually, as like happens to kind of everybody, like my deep like sadness started to be interrupted by like humor and hope. And like at a certain point, that humor and that hope start to like overcome that sadness, right? And like, so really from, and I don't actually tend to like think about this too much, like when I'm writing, like what my current mental state is, but like in hindsight, like looking at this book, it's like, okay, so even in that scene in the bathroom that I read, this like guy in like a Cleveland Browns jersey, just like being kind to this person in trouble and like demanding like kindness from other people, like that just that like feels like in this small way, like we can take those stands like in our daily life, right? We can say like, wait, stop being like a jerk to like this person, right? And like there's weird like hope and like obviously humor
right
in that, and so you can't really avoid it, right? Like nothing, no matter how, like, you know, it's obviously like there's a scale to this, but no matter how much of like a sad sack you become, you can't just outrun that there are like glimmers of like the good.
Right. The people like, are going to be kind once in a while, yeah, at exactly. minimum, and they're usually going to be try to be funny. And sometimes yeah. there will be.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're going to start talking about LSD in the middle of a speech on kindness.
Yeah. It's just totally like unexpected. And I think that, And like, I think like in the writing of it, like focusing on those moments, like felt natural because like everyone is like so sad, like having these sad people experiencing these small moments of kindness, like just creates this interesting like juxtaposition and like energy almost, right? Like, so there's not real focus on like the sadness of, we just like, okay, we know these people are sad.
Right.
Like we know life is hard. Like what else is going on?
They're also. I mean, I would say too, with that is one of the things that is going on is they're fighting to kind of not to be, or at least to get into a less miserable position when they're in a miserable position. So, so I think that inherently is like is the stuff of hope And I'm not even like particularly one of these people that's like, we need hopeful literature. Yeah, no. Like, but no, I'm just, it works here. It's not that sappy kind of hope. It's not all dire. Yeah, even in suffering, you have moments of respite that are kind of.
Yeah, and like I've become obsessed with, and maybe it's like just because in my like classes I'm kind of like teaching this stuff mm-hmm. a lot, but like I've become obsessed with these moments of like epiphany, like these moments of like greater understanding. So like I'm thinking like specifically of this William Trevor story, The Day We Got Drunk on Cake. Right, like there's like this long like final paragraph. This guy is like in a relationship that's not working out. Like he's out day drinking with his friends. He's like he keeps like calling his ex-girlfriend and she's like getting increasingly annoyed like as this goes on. You know, something that we can all relate to probably. Like as he drinks more and like calls more, right? And she's like, just you have to stop. And he has this moment where like he's okay, he like finally decides to I'm not gonna give away too much, but he like finally says, okay, like I'm just gonna move on with my life. And he like opens this door to like leave this party that he's at. And in this moment, he just has this like greater understanding of like time passing and like romance and like the, I don't know, just like these like glimmers of our life that like we feel are really important in the moment, but like kind of pass away. And it's kind of like hokey, but I'm obsessed with that. And like, now I'm thinking of, and I think about this actually a lot, is that there's a section, maybe like a 30 or 40 page, you can correct me, like section in Mount Chicago towards the end, where it's like the most kind of heartbreaking situation one of our character, like a character that we love, can like find themselves in, both like a writer and a reader. But it's just filled with like so much like beauty and love and like, you know, nostalgia, not like in a corny way. Yeah, so I don't know. I think about that a lot too.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, no. I mean, I think that's. I think that is that thing that you know. Hopefully, and I think you do it a lot. That they're to catch those moments. The I don't think of them as epiphanies. I don't know why I resist that word. Mm-hmm. There's probably no good reason. It's probably real stuck up and got it from someone else. But those types of moments. Where those glimmers are, I like that word, and I think that what's really nice, I think that one of the great things that fiction can do is to sort of tattoo those down on the page, like it's like okay, name the thing. It's not just a referring to a thing. It's not just like, and there was a glimmer. It's like this is how it feels. It's to give the reader that sense, and they can also go back and look at it again, like in a way you can't in life.
Yeah, like, or you can't in like other like forms of art too, mm-hmm. right? Like yes. The way like you can't really do like those whatever, just moments of intense interiority or mm-hmm. something, right? Like mm-hmm. you just can't really pull off in on the screen, yep. right? Or,
like, yeah. And there's often like a kind of kind of violence to it, right? Like I always think yeah. of the first time I was taught about epiphany, it had something to do with Joyce and with Araby by Joyce.
Yeah.
And the end of that story, and I'm like, that's a dark ending. Like, that's a dark opinion. You know, it's, I can't remember the line right now, but yeah, witnessed myself as like basically ugly Satan. And it's done. I mean, it sounds cool though. It doesn't sound like someone saying ugly Satan. So these are great moments. Yeah. We kind of covered you. You're good at this, man. My other questions are have been obsolesced.
Well, we can do it. We can open it up.
We'll do a Q&A?
Yeah, we can open it up.
So you've probably read this in the review, in the New York Times review, but one of the interesting things I thought at the end was how the reviewer talked about how he rarely would ask for a book to be longer and wanted to know more about these characters. And so I just wondered if you were tempted at all to go on and on.
Yeah, and hey, Mrs. Andrew. I've known her my entire life.
Oh, hey, Mrs. Andrew.
I don't know. Like, and I think that this actually, I think it'd be nice to kind of go back and forth on it, because you are someone that like writes long.
What do you mean?
Well, I know. You know, it's probably 2,000 pages. But okay, so I was thinking. I didn't think that this book like could be longer, like when I was writing it. And the reason I can be certain with that, like, and from my intentions, is like I'm working on something now that I feel like can be really long, and like I don't know where it ends. Like, I don't know all the different threads that happen. Like, I'm probably around, I think, like 100 pages, give or take, into it, and it feels like it's just starting, right? In this way, it's really cool and exciting. With this book, like, right when I started writing all the threads, or maybe, you know, not right away, but a couple months into, like, writing all the threads, like, I just knew, okay, this one's going to end this way. Right, like this is what's going to happen to this character. And so I feel like that desire, like I understand that desire to spend more time with them, like for this book to be longer, like to expand it. But what I think about this book and what I thought about, like, Everywhere You Don't Belong, because I heard a similar thing about Everywhere You Don't Belong, and maybe it's because it's a coming of age story that stops when the narrator is like 18. Right. And so it's like, what's the life like? Life, you know, hopefully life doesn't stop when we're 18 and it changes like drastically. But both of those books, like that one and this one, like they appeared to me, like in the writing of them, that they were just snapshots of these characters' lives. Right. So like, here's Sojourner and Bounce before they meet each other, when they meet each other, when they're trying to like find this place in the mountains. Like, here's Rio and Gibraltar after tragedy, trying to like make this project work, and then like watching it fail. And I feel like each character has had a start and stop point in my mind. And so I can get like someone wanting either the start point to start earlier, or the end point to like end later, or like the middle to be expanded, like whatever it is. But for me, that's just how like the writing came and how it like settled on itself, like after, you know, serious drafting too. Like, and so there's in like the writing of these things, like the editing of these things, you have all this time to like second guess yourself. And then like the book comes out and then you second guess yourself in like these different ways, right? But I feel like, and there are things that like I do like wonder if I did write, or, you know, just, I think that's just human nature. But the timeline isn't one of those things, right? Like, that's something I can really just kind of stand behind and say, that's what I wanted this book to be.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think, yeah, revision is like obviously like the biggest thing. Like, I mean, I think, and I saw your, you know, your pre-published work, mm-hmm, in various iterations, and like you were really hardcore about it. And I always thought that was great. That's always how I was taught, and what I did is, you know, you want to toss most of what you write. Like, most of what you write should be gone. Like, most writing, well, I don't want to get all negative, but like most of what comes out is not as good as it could be. It's not like, if you were a reader, you wouldn't feel great about coming across it, and that's, mm-hmm, that should be the goal. And I think, you know, you always did that. Like, it's like trimming stuff and also just massive cuts.
I have a question more kind of about the tour itself, but you wrote this book like a while ago, mm-hmm, and I imagine haven't been thinking about the characters literally every day since. And I'm curious what it's like now that it's coming out to like reconnect with them after so many years.
Yeah. Hey, Alex. Well, I mean, like, I think there's all these ways that, like, this book, I'm just experiencing differently than I would, like, normally experience a work of fiction. They're, like, certainly not with, like, my first book, and maybe something else. So, like, I guess just to be direct about it, like, I've been thinking a lot about these characters, especially this past year. Because my, like, wife and I, so, like, Laura and I, we experienced this, like, late-term miscarriage earlier this year in January. And that's one of the inciting events of this book, is, like, this couple experiences child loss in this unexpected way. And when I wrote those sections 5 years ago, you know, I wasn't thinking about having children or anything. Like, I just wrote that thing happening to these people because I was like, what's the worst thing I could imagine like happening to these people, right? Like, what is the thing that can really push them over the edge? And I was doing like, it's so strange how this process works. I was doing like copy edits of this book, like when it was going on. Like I had to do some like passes when like I was taking some time off from work, and like I had to like go back and look at stuff. And some of it was interesting in that, like, so I went back to the sections where they lose their daughter drop. And I was like, okay, how do they feel? Like, because I don't really necessarily care about getting emotions like true to reality. Mm-hmm. It was more like I was just interested, like, did I get that right? Like, is that how I feel? And it was like totally how I felt. Like, it was just this total earth shattering moment. Like, everything just felt to, it was like kind of falling away. And like, I remember, like, so Gibraltar, the husband, this is like more kind of like directly to your question. So like Gibraltar, the husband of Rio, who like comes up with this idea for it. Originally he, and this is like a rude thing to say about your characters, but like, I didn't like really care about Gibraltar that much, like in the writing.
It's rude, man.
Of this book, I know, like he's, like I just, I don't know, I wasn't like that. He was, you know, he was just like a steady force, you know, to plan it. And then mainly because like I wasn't a dad and like a husband, like worked in academia, like I couldn't really relate to him like that. And now I kind of relate to him most out of all the characters in this book. Like when I started writing, I feel like I related to like Bounce the most, like just the sad young man in his late 20s. Those kind of just kept feeling like a failure and like messing up. Okay, like I can relate to that guy. But now, like, it's, I don't know, like, Gibraltar kind of feels like me in this way that's totally unexpected. And mainly because, like, when Rio comes up with this idea to, like, build this utopia, to, like, go underground, like, it's just so, like, crazy, right? It's, like, so out there. But the fact that, like, Gibraltar is supportive of it and, like, wants to, like, just do anything to make his wife, like, feel happy in that moment, like, we'll do anything for her. I was like, yeah, I would have done that. Like if Lauren told me like, hey, like I have this like really crazy idea. Like, I mean, we're moving to like New York, you know, like I've never wanted to live in New York. Like I just really love my wife and like think that her like happiness matters. And it'd also be fun. Like we also like have lots, you live in New York. Right? So like that's good. But
it's not under a mountain.
Yeah, I know. It's like, it's just an example, right? Like it's these things that we do to like try and make, to make the people that like sure. we really care about happily.
Well, first, thank you both for being here today. You talked a little bit about character earlier, but I'm actually interested in the setting of the novel. Both this book and your previous book had a strong sense of like place. I feel like whether like Chicago and Missouri in the last book, and then obviously Massachusetts here. Did you always have in your mind that the utopia would be in Western Massachusetts, or could it have been anywhere?
Yeah. Like where all utopias are, right?
Yeah, and actually there is this history.
Is it really?
Not even like a joke. There's like a history of people, first, I think a lot of anthropological reasons, just people detached from reality, like living in that area. But whatever, like I knew the book was going to be set there because like I tend to just write from familiar settings. So like Everywhere You Don't Belong, like it's just in the neighborhood, like really the street, right? Like I grew up on, even though it's not like an autobiographical like novel, I like working with like settings that I'm familiar with. And so I knew that like I was going to write a Western Mass book. And like, and when I was there, I became, cause I had to drive out to like Boston a lot when I was living in a small town called Montague for a couple of years. And I'd have to pass over this bridge, like which is in the book, like it's called the French King Bridge. And I thought that was a really cool name for a bridge. And then like above the bridge was like this thing called the French King like restaurant and like motel. I think I don't know if it was a hotel or a motel, but like I would drive past and no one ever really seemed to like be in there, right? But it wasn't abandoned. Like it was like operating, but nobody was in there. And it was like beautiful. There's this gorgeous, it was over the Connecticut River. And so it was this huge valley. And in like the spring, and everything is like really lush and green. And so I became obsessed with that place. And then when the idea of this like utopia started forming, it just seemed like the obvious place to put it, just like in there, like in the mountain. So yeah, like, so I think some of it just happens like in the writing of, you kind of become obsessed with these like things. Like in most of my writing, I'm pretty obsessed with like bodies of water, or just some, maybe it's growing up close to Lake Michigan, but there's always like a body of water like somewhere in my books. It's like a scavenger hunt. But thank you.
All right, folks, I think that's about the last we'll have time for today. So thank you again, and thank you both for that wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.